interview with Ronnie, R-O-N-N-I-E, Duggar, D-U-G-G-E-R, publisher of the Texas Observer, Austin, Texas, December 11th, 1974.
What's been the biggest change in Texas politics the last 25 years?
Well,
since the last 20 years to the life of the Texas Observer.
There's been a subtle acceptance of the progressive environment, the change of milieu, the cultural change. There's been a subtle movement forward. I wouldn't say leftward. I'd say more, you know, into the period. There's been a subtle moderation of the harsh epithemes of the right. For example, 20 years ago, federal aid to education was unthinkable. Now it's accepted. Sympathy for the poor was unthinkable. Sort of communist, now it's accepted. Not enforced, but accepted. Blacks have been integrated in an ostensible aspect, whereas that was unthinkable 20 years ago. Generally, the state has moved with the country somewhat toward civility, but fundamentally it's not changed. Fundamentally, it's still governed, in my opinion, by the principal corporate interests.
Changes that race has been removed as a significant issue over the last 20 years?
No, it's still a significant issue.
And statewide politics?
Yeah. For example, McGovern did less good than he would have because of the Wallace feeling in the labor movement. There's a Wallace feeling hurt Farenthold. Labor has not. Labor didn't endorse Farenthold. Really, didn't. No, the race thing is still there. It's residual rather than overt. I think perhaps it's true in the border states, it certainly is in Texas, that people are rather shamefaced to say nigger. That's really the difference. But there's surely a residual prejudice, and it's surely a large political factor. Otherwise, Wallace wouldn't be so strong, I think.
Well, you still agree with the BOK when he said that the key to understanding Texas politics is to understand how the big money goes?
No, that's too simple. Another thing that's changed in the last 20 years has been the emergence of a somewhat uneven but continuously present urban political base. The most conspicuous example of it has been the Harris County Democrats in Houston. Less even but just as persistent has been the Bexar County Democrats. The key to understanding Texas politics, I don't know what the key is, but it's not that simple. It has to do with an intuition that would keep the principal variables in solution. And the principal variables certainly include big money, out-of-state capital, as it relates to what you might call the politicization of individualism, of rugged Western macho. When that became politicized, the individual was connected to the corporate in a way that most individuals don't really understand. It's a very potent connection. But you have to keep that in solution with the dynamic facts that we have 2 million Mexican Americans. We have 1.5 million blacks. And these form the fundament of a divided, of half of a divided state. I mean, it's a divided state. There's a stereotype about that the state is conservative. I don't think that's true. I think it's divided. And about half and half, or more literally, probably 40-40 with 20 in the middle. About 40-40. If the blacks and Chicanos voted in proportion to the wealthier voters and the more conservative voters, it would be a liberal state. I think fundamentally it is a liberal state, but that the prism is clouded over by the effects of money.
What do you see it going in the next 10 years? I think it's going to stay pretty much the way it is.
Well, on a few occasions in the past, the progressives and liberals have almost won the governorship. They did win with Yarbrough. Now, why that happened, when it did, and when it almost did, is difficult to say. I think Don Yarbrough would have been governor if Connally hadn't been shot with Kennedy. That's probably true. And why, I don't know. I am not optimistic about the general direction of the country in terms of my values, the progressive values. I think the National Democratic Party looks increasingly like the Texas Democratic Party did in the 1950s. And Strauss and people like that are singing harmony as a way of repressing dissent nationally, like they did in Texas in the 50s. I'm afraid the direction is toward the nationalization of harmony. Now, what'll happen, I don't know. I mean, it really is, it's sort of like what happens to the country. It's up for grabs. What happens to nuclear war? I don't know. It's all in doubt. If national politics is Europeanized in the 1976 by, say, three or four parties, the same thing can happen to Texas politics. And in a Europeanized environment where people are running as independents, I don't think La Raza can make it, but it's hard to predict. I think all you can usefully say about the future is that, seen realistically, the fundament of the political culture is truly divided. It's truly split. And that the black and Chicano self-interest, being so fundamentally progressive in its political aspects, will not go away. So that there's no reason to think, you know, that the conservatives are going to consolidate irreversibly, unless they do nationally, which they might.
What's the role and effect of La Raza Unida?
La Raza, in my opinion, is largely the responsive extension of José Ángel Gutiérrez, who is a powerful, angry Chicano intellectual, revolutionary. I think actually La Raza, I think José Ángel would like, from what I have read about his views and heard about his views, would like a Mexican nation or state. He really wants, he's separatist in a fundamentally radical way. Now, in my opinion, La Raza is using the electoral process for purposes not really related to the electoral process. It is fundamentally a pre-revolutionary usage of the electoral process. Now, its effects are another matter, but its purposes do not seem to me to be essentially electoral, except locally. Statewide, its purposes are not essentially electoral. Its effects are obvious. It takes votes from the liberals. La Raza should have learned something in the last local elections. They got about, in the university community around Austin, they got about, as I recall, you can check the figures, 15% against Wisco. When they ran against the most liberal candidates for the legislature, they went down to 3%. So the vote for La Raza is a disgust vote, except for, say, 3 or 4% of whatever it gets. It's fundamentally a disgust vote, which is not too significant, because the minute a liberal alternative comes along, well, they vote for it. Am I helpful on that?
Has it had the effect on the Democratic Party of making them more open in terms of access and trying to give Mexican Americans a larger voice?
No. Because, no, it has not, in my opinion. La Raza has had almost no effect on the statewide Democratic Party or on the statewide liberal movement. It has had, there have been embitterings, but opening the Democratic Party has been the work undertaken by people like Joe Bernal, the Democratic National Committeeman from San Antonio, or Leonel Castillo, the Democratic Comptroller of the City of Houston. They have undertaken to carry the Chicano message forward into the Democratic Party. They are the ones doing the fights. Now, rhetorically and argumentatively, they, and in fact I, have argued to the Democratic Party, look, we have a third party already to cope with, and if you are not open and responsive to the Mexican Americans, that is a danger. And I guess that has some weight, but not much. I think, you see, La Raza, if people thought it could win, yes, the answer would be yes. But people really do not anymore think that La Raza can win. It is not a party on the rise. It's like the populists after 1892.
In your opinion, it has already peaked.
Well,
in terms of statewide influence.
I really scruple against predicting as though one knows the future. The recent shape of its electoral returns are declining, which is not good news for it. That doesn't say that La Raza might not be a part, if it could consent. Hi, Rosalind. If it consent, hi, Eden. If it consent to be a part of anything, that it might not become a part of a more effective third party or independent movement in the future. I don't know. It might. Jose Angel Gutierrez is not to be underestimated. He's a very intelligent man. Very cool. I occasionally make statements that are very hot-headed, but he seems to know that he's doing that when he does it. You should go see him.
Was Daddy at the convention?
He certainly was.
Do you see, is any move toward blacks and Chicanos getting even informally but actively together in a coalition?
Yes, that happens. Happens nationally, it happens in this state.
Does it happen consciously?
Well, there is a separatism that works between them. And it's also very complex about the black leadership. The black leadership, for example, centered in Houston, which is where the dominant black leadership is in this state, is divided between those who are tough or are regarded by folks like me as tough blacks, and those who cope very gingerly with the problem of being effective by relating to the power that is, against whom considerable bitterness is directed. That bifurcation, it's almost a bifurcation in the black leadership, makes it difficult to have an effective liaison between the caucuses, because it makes it difficult to have an effective black caucus.
Where does Barbara Jordan fit into that?
Jordan has become increasingly a black who is used by the white power structure, in my opinion. By white power structure, I mean the white power structure in the Democratic Party. She is used sort of to the right of the center, of the left half of the spectrum. By used, I don't mean that she's doing anything she doesn't. I think I want to take that back and take it off the record and start the answer again, because it tends to reflect on her in a way I didn't intend. Can I start that answer again? At the Democratic National Conference, it was the information I had from leading black national level delegates that Barbara was isolated. She was not really with the black caucus. She was operating independently, and she was on the stage much of the time because what she chose to do was also, as it happened, what Strauss wanted done and said by blacks. It seems to me increasingly that the white moderate to conservative establishment in the Democratic Party looks for prominent and articulate blacks whose views tend to mesh with theirs, and then push them forward. The national black leaders are becoming aware that they have a serious internal problem, because they cannot publicly criticize their soul brothers or sisters. The whites are not in a position to, you know, effectively to do much about that, and so there's really not much being done about that. But in my opinion, Barbara Jordan is a national liberal of the finest kind. She votes splendidly in the legislature, but she has become increasingly associated with conservative impact, state level and national party level figures. I had an interesting conversation about this very problem with a black legislator from Houston the other day in Kansas City. And he was explaining to me that in the black community, to be effective is very important. and that there is enough disgust with everything white, that there is some thought running in the black community that it doesn't really matter which whites you relate to as long as you get for blacks. The trouble with that narrowing of the focus, as I was responsibly arguing back to my friend who's involved in this kind of compromising, is that it tends to commit the energies of one of the main sources of the energy for broad gauge social reform to conservatives or to people who in their impacts are in the net conservative, and that is a very serious thing for black leaders to do. So it's a real dilemma that, well, now on the other hand, it seems to me that the Chicano Democratic Caucus in this state is very strong. It is fundamentally based in San Antonio and Houston, with scatterings down through Corpus Christi and the Valley. And I think perhaps the shortest hand way to describe it is by naming Joe Bernal and Leonel Castillo. Castillo, who has only about 10% Chicanos in his constituency, has the largest constituency of any Chicano, any elected Chicano in the United States. Bernal was a state senator who got beat, and incidentally, La Raza Unida didn't help him a damn bit. La Raza, you know, can turn elections, but whose fidelity to progressive causes and to the Chicano cause just leaves him in a very strong position. Nevertheless, as I recall, he's a member of the Democratic National Committee. Well, it's a very strong caucus, and of course they have complexities of exactly the same kind, where you're drawn toward power to get benefits for your people, even though so doing you advance causes that in the larger way hurt your people as well as the general welfare. But it seems to me that operatively, to the extent the black and Chicano caucuses cohere around progressive causes and candidates, they certainly cooperate. Certainly do.
But it's not a conscious getting together, am I correct?
Well, I don't know of joint caucuses, no. But that's not the nature of the beast. The coalition beast is separatism. At Kansas City, the women caucus separately, the blacks caucus separately, the Chicanos caucus separately, the youth caucus separately. Separatism is the essence of the need for caucuses. In fact, I've begun to advance the suggestion to friends of mine in the women's caucus and others that we need a white progressive male caucus, because in a caucusing environment, in a convention, the white males, progressive males, go around hangdog like they've just shot their mother or something, and utterly inefficacious. So why not form a caucus? You see, it's a separatist phenomenon. So that is not to say that there's not all kinds of interaction.
What's been the impact of the Observer on Texas politics in the year 20th anniversary?
Well, since your book will be on after that, let me refer you to the 20th anniversary piece I did. I mean, I really tried to talk about that. And I think I said it better then, and I could try to re-say it. I think we've done a lot of good and basically have failed. If the purpose was really to try to break the political culture free from corporate domination, the purpose has not succeeded. But a great deal of good has been done, and I try to... go ahead.
Will it stop running?
But a great deal of good has been done, and I try to specify the different kinds of good I think we've done. I think it's a better state than it would have been if the Observer hadn't been there.
You were speculating when you walked in. How come Texas could support a paper like this and no other state, South Carolina is Osceola, no other state in the South or indeed the rest of the country?
A lot of them have tried. I understand they just started a Hawaiian Observer.
You've lasted 20 years.
Because probably special and particular circumstances. One was it was very firmly begun in sound journalism, if you'll pardon this simplified statement of the fact. Another was that it had 7 or 8 years to grow on a subsidy. It was basically an investment subsidy. That is, Mrs. Randolph went ahead and invested in it until I could put it on its own feet. It now sustains its income out of its costs. The third reason is, if it's, and I think it's still a unique reason, it's had for 20 years people who would sacrifice to work on it. I mean, financially and reputationally sacrifice. Now, actually now working on the Observer is reputationally a boon. Many people go from the Observer nationally. But at first it was not. And people are willing to take a chance. So I don't know. I think you could have an Observer in Georgia. I think Atlanta would sustain an Observer. New York doesn't need one. It's got the New York Post. And I mean, if the culture has to be negative in terms of progressive light in the first place, so Georgia could probably sustain one. California has tried, but it really doesn't need one. It has the San Francisco Chronicle and, you know. Sorry, you said Texas as well.
Supports a fairly large liberal community.
Yes, and no liberal newspapers. So there's a need.
I know you can make it through there, but I don't know.
That's why a place like Georgia could do it. A place like Florida could do an Observer. Maybe even a place like Pennsylvania. But the environment in the first place has to be negative with respect to what liberals or progressives would consider political enlightenment. In the second place, you've got to have very good journalism, because when you're on the knife edge, if you make a mistake, it cuts deeper. It cuts you deeper. So you have to be careful about the mistakes you make. In third place, you've got to have financial backing that will last while you do the very difficult thing of trying to find the liberals and the leftists and the idealists, trying to find them. The practical problem in circulation drives was always, where are they? We knew there were, half a million people would vote for liberal and progressive candidates, but where were they? And furthermore, another problem was, and is, that a serious attention to public affairs at the state and local level is more than most people want, even no matter how they vote. They really don't want that to think about it that much. So you really get into a pretty narrowed potentiality, although a very efficacious one if you can survive, because, as you know, the politicians, both sides, and people I guess we'd call the elite of some kind, read it if you survive. I think the reason the Observer has survived for 20 years is that at several junctures, a number of us have consciously made sacrifices to keep it going.
Is the difference between the liberal community and the conservative community today than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago? Are you still fighting about the same issues?
No, it's different issues. And the conservative community is more sophisticated than it was, it seems to me, 20 years ago. It was a very low level of political information and culture 20 years ago in Texas. People on the Democratic, loyal liberal Democratic side were shocked when I put liberal on the masthead of the Observer. I mean, there's much more, I mean, if there is a, I don't believe in inevitable progress, but I think this, the whole country is more sophisticated. Look what's happened to the country. 20 years ago, you wouldn't have thought about a cultural revolution like we had in the 60s being tolerated. It wasn't tolerated at the beginning of the 60s. We're a much more European country now, and the state of Texas is more European too. Much more sophisticated.
But are the basic differences still, for example, on taxation?
Well?
We keep hearing about the growth of the moderates in Texas. How would you define it?
Moderates?
We came up with four Democratic parties. Liberal, moderate, conservative, and Wallace.
Well, yeah, you can look at it that way. You can look at it that way, but I think it's not quite real. I think the major elections polarize into the middle, the right, and the left. And the left is about 40%, and the right is about 40%, including Wallace, and the middle is about 20%. That's about the way it is.
Yeah, but the 40% on the left don't register and don't vote.
No, that's about 40% of the vote. That's the way it is. I mean, Yarbrough would start with 40% every damn time he would run. No, if they voted, it would be a majority. No. But to call it a four-party state is unreal. It's unrealistic. I mean, it's either a no-party state because the Democratic Party is not truly a party, but a way of neutralizing the left. It's a means of neutralizing the left. You can say it's a three-party state if you see the Republican Party as one party, the Conservative Democrats as another, and the Liberal Democrats as another. But you really do blur it up if you. I mean, I understand that there are people who would say I'm neither conservative nor liberal progressive, but I'm moderate. I understand that. But in operative fact, they go one way or the other and get counted, they get shorn as wolves or sheep, one way or the other.
Are any statewide liberal leaders?
Yeah. Well, I'd hate to say. I'd hate to say. I think it's kind of invidious to say off the top of your head who statewide. Wouldn't it be, for example, for the Mexican Americans to say who their leaders are, and for the blacks to say?
What I'm saying is, there anybody in statewide office that's identified as a liberal?
Well, of course, that's too exact a question using that term. Bob Armstrong is considered something like a moderate progressive. Probably, my opinion is that Armstrong is probably the most progressive of all present state office holders. John Hill is probably somewhat more toward the center than Armstrong, but neither is he a conservative. I would not call either Armstrong or Hill a conservative.
Or would you call him a liberal?
That's right.
Progressive.
How about Hobby?
Hobby is, I don't know. I don't know what to make of Hobby. And he does some things that would be conservative and some things that would be progressive, although not necessarily liberal. He's a hard case, mainly because I think he has to decide when he runs for governor whether to run as a conservative. If Hill or Armstrong becomes the standard bearer of the reformers, that of the left, well then Hobby will have to take the other side. I think he might be jimmied by that structural logic into being more conservative than he would be otherwise. I just don't know. You don't get a clear picture from Hobby of his ideology. In my opinion, both Armstrong and Hill have a good deal to be said for them from a progressive point of view. But I wouldn't want to label them. They're both thoughtful people, and they've both done some things that take some character, and they've also done some things, particularly Hill has done some things that I don't agree with. But Armstrong has not done a whole lot of things that I don't agree with. I really think from my personal point of view, he's a very good person.
What about Briscoe?
Well, Briscoe just really doesn't matter much. He's a sort of a caretaker conservative. He just doesn't matter much. The real drama in the election in which he was elected was between Farenthold and Barnes. Barnes was a very strong, viable, conservative, moderate, with appeal to the liberals guy. And defeating Barnes was a sophisticated purpose of a lot of people I have confidence in. That is, he was, in my opinion, a dangerous political figure because he was so viable and yet fundamentally so conservative. He was politically viable and fundamentally conservative, in my opinion. Not stereotyped. And Farenthold was beating him. The polls showed Farenthold was beating him. Apparently they were taking daily polls in the conservative camp. I've heard this story. Farenthold will tell it to you. And one day it showed the polls convinced them that... Hi, Jeff.
Do you want me to leave?
No, please sit down. This is my friend Jeff Jones. Jack Bass. And at one point they saw... The polls came in and they saw that Barnes was beat. And Briscoe was in the race and they just jettisoned Barnes. I mean, you can see the switch of power. And at that point, Briscoe was elected. Well, he has not been a consequential governor. He has not done very much. He generally doesn't know what's going on. In the Constitutional Convention, he did not intervene. It just doesn't matter much. He's a caretaker governor.
So why was there no formidable opposition during this time? Why is he popular?
Well, Farenthold might have been... why is he popular? Probably because people are sick of politics. And as long as he hasn't done anything wrong, it's all right. Farenthold...
He promised to be honest, and he has been. Is that basically it?
Accepted a standpoint.
Well, I don't... No, I wouldn't go that. I wouldn't say that. You said that. I mean, I don't...
I'm asking. I asked it. I didn't say it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't... People obviously didn't have much against him. He also said he kept his promises. That was argued, but people apparently concluded that he had. But I think the basic thing is that people were negative about politics, and a crusade was not.
Ronnie, why didn't somebody jump in against him in 74?
I didn't hear.
Farenthold ran against him.
Why didn't anybody else?
Oh, lack of guts.
Hill and Hobby and
Martin. Lack of guts. What else?
Suppose they had.
They figured they'd lose.
Would they?
I don't know. Who the hell can know? I mean, they all decided not to do it, and Farenthold found herself down at the wire with nobody running. She knew nobody was going to run. Everybody told her they weren't going to run, so it was only Farenthold.
But if she had not run, I mean, they did not run then because she was running. She ran because they weren't running.
That's right. That was the way it was. I was with her while she was thinking about it, and if Armstrong had announced, she would not have run. If Hobby had announced, I don't know if she'd have run. But if Hill had announced, she wouldn't have run.
You know if they were taking any polls that showed Briscoe being that strong?
I don't know. It's in my memory that they were, but I don't know.
Well, if you look at the potential field of candidates...
Also, there's a second term tradition. I mean, that was the basic context, that you couldn't beat Briscoe for a second term, because that's a tradition in Texas. You almost never beat a seated governor a second term. Excuse me. That was the context in which they made a decision that I regard as rather overcautious. Go ahead.
Look at Hill and Hobby and some of the others that I mentioned from 1978. Doesn't it suggest that Texas politics is almost going to become more moderate in that election? This has to become like the field of candidates.
Yes, it does. That's correct. And another thing that's very important, I mean, if you think that politics is going to flow with personality instead of personality with political forces, you know, and I think there's a fallacy in thinking that way. Candidates tend to appear to express forces that exist, and that might happen. Another negative thing that's happened recently is that, you'll find it in a recent Observer in my column, we've just gone into a four-year cycle setting statewide elections in off-presidential years. And this has serious implications for turnout. I mean, you have a minimum interest in off-presidential years, obviously. Now, what exactly that will mean, I don't know, but it certainly means that the Republicans are in bad shape in this state. The two-party system cause is in bad shape because the principal hope for a two-party system is riding a president's coattails and thus shaking, you know, that's the most practical way you change a state into a two-party system. That is now wiped out by the Democratic legislature, a very shrewd move. I don't think that necessarily means that the politics in the primaries are profoundly or permanently affected, because who's going to stay home? You just don't know what the proportions by ideology of who stays home the most in an off-presidential year are. I don't know those facts. I don't think anybody else can know them. It's an unpredictable event. But I wouldn't say... I think you're... In the first place, a lot of people are assuming that Armstrong won't run. I think if Armstrong ran and was elected, you would have a progressive state. Hill might be... I mean, politicians are responsive to forces. And Hill is a responsive person. He's a person of character. And he might also see that in order to win, he has to be right with the black. He has to be right with the Chicanos, and he has to be at least mainly right with the with the intellectuals among those caucuses and among the Anglos, you know, the progressive intellectuals. You've got forces at work that a guy like Hill, for example, if he's running for governor, has to keep in mind that it's not just a question of who votes for whom, but who's enthusiastic about whom, who has workers, what happens on the campuses, the new fact, the new force. If the candidate for governor does not get enthusiasm on the campuses, he's missing a major bet if he's a progressive candidate, you see. So that's all going to cause... the politicians are creatures.
Is the role of money going to diminish?
What?
Is the role of money going to diminish for campaigns?
Well, I really don't know. You know, the whole tendency of the trends in the law would indicate so. I guess I'm not too optimistic about that yet. Are you?
Well, it's always seemed to be very important.
But those reforms, how much do they really affect state-level politics? Not much. California has passed a strict post-Watergate campaign finance law, but we have not. And until the states do that, I think you can greatly exaggerate the effects of the federal law on state politics.
Is it an oversimplification to say that in the 50s, Shimmer's really dominated that era, the 60s is Connolly, the 70s is really nobody? You got Preston Smith.
And yeah, that's kind of an oversimplification, like everything is. In the 50s, Shivers was dominating until 1956, and that was the end of it. The scandals that began breaking in 54 wiped him out. So he dominated from 49 through 56, and that was the end of that. After that, I'd say it was a contest in Texas between Johnson and Price Daniel in one grouping and Yarbrough in the other. And Yarbrough got elected, and a movement went into the 60s. It was a very complicated contest. Basically divided between the Price Daniel moderate conservatives with the hangover from Shivers in there. The Johnson moderates were aligned with the conservatives, and the Yarbrough reformers, who were about 40% on the other side. When you got into the 60s, a fight began between the progressives and the Connolly people. Daniel went too far in the legislature against oil and gas lobbyists, and business dropped him. He was done for because of that. Really, I think mainly because of that. And Connolly came in, speculated to be Lyndon's boy, denying that. And Connolly dominated Texas politics from 62 through 68, wasn't it? But that is a very deceptive thing to say. Actually, Johnson dominated Texas politics from 62 to 68. Connolly was merely his agent. I mean, he was Johnson's governor, in spite of all of his stuffed shirt independence of Johnson. You know, he was really Johnson's governor. When you have a president from a state, he dominates the state. That's all there is to it. Connolly was strong in the legislature. Johnson didn't care much about that, so in that sense you could say Connolly dominated state politics. But I would say through the 60s there was no really significant liberal candidacy after Kennedy was shot.
69 through 74, there really is no dominant. Right about Briscoe, he won't be dominant the next 4 years.
Apparently,
so
he
may
won't.
Have a period there where there is no dominant political.
I was just reading a piece by Harry McPherson in the Washington Post that the nation is without leaders, not only political but cultural and artistic and musical. Certainly, Farenthold was a strong starter, a strong drive in that period you're mentioning. She's still potent, she's still influential, but that second governor's race hurt her, obviously, a lot in terms of her clout in Texas. I'd say on the left now in Texas, there is not anybody as conspicuous as, well, Connolly in the 60s, and on the right, there isn't either. Briscoe is the ostensible leader, but he's not very strong. Now, what we're getting into, obviously, is the subject of Benson. And
before we get into
talk about Benson,
before we get into that, I want to make sure I understand just what went into Tower. Let's go into Tower first. My understanding is that Tower got elected. The liberals supported Tower because they were trying to get the get rid of the conservative domination of the Democratic Party.
Well,
but if you would elaborate on that period.
Some liberals supported Tower for that on that logic.
Enough to elect him.
A margin of them. And he was elected, as I recall, by 10,000 votes. Generally, those liberals were... The Tower's election was attributed to those liberals as the swing factor. The logic at that time was that the A way to get a two-party state, the virtues of which were taken to be self-evident, was to encourage the Republicans by giving them some offices. And then the conservative Democrats, who voted Republican every presidential year anyhow, would flock as to the piper's tune to the winning side. And so on that theory, that's right, Tower was elected.
Whoops.
It was not. Is that just a battery? Or that doesn't break the current? On that theory, Tower was elected, and then he was re-elected, and now we find that defeating him would be a major project. The theory obviously is inoperative. He's one of the most conservative mossbacks in the United States Senate, and if the Democratic movement could have beaten him, they would have. But when Barefoot tried, Barefoot was too moderate to really, get much enthusiasm from the liberals, although there was enough enthusiasm to appear to be enthusiastic. No, he's a very tough guy. He's an incumbent. He's hard to beat. But that is not a Republican presence in Texas. I'm about convinced that the only way you really have a two-party state is have the governor's office. If you don't have the governor's office, if you've never in recent times had the governor's office, you don't have a two-party state. You can have a few legislative seats, you can have a Senate seat, and they have some patronage. But in a one where there's a one-party tradition, and now with the elections and off years, it's all over. There's not going to be a two-party state anytime soon in Texas.
So you may, if one of the moderates win next time for governor, then what do you be as a one-party state dominated by a moderate Democratic Party as opposed to a conservative Democratic Party? Well, I mean, it looks
like
Texas.
I don't know what those words mean. You use those words as though they had content. They don't. What do you mean? I mean, moderate. What does that mean?
We've been asking for 3 days. What the hell does moderate mean in Texas? What does liberal mean?
Does it split on taxation? Is that the question where it splits?
Role of government? What is it?
Well, I mean, you have to go to history. I mean, the general sales tax was passed in 1961 with the liberals opposed and the conservatives for it. Moderate hell, you voted yes or no, and they voted aye, and the majority carried it. Moderate probably is just a word that politicians like to use to escape labels that they fear will cost them votes. I mean, they take middle positions.
But on what issues does it split? Does it split on the question of sales tax on food?
Sure.
Corporate income tax?
Sure.
Personal income tax?
Sure. No, the liberals are generally not courageous enough to be for a personal income tax, the office-seeking liberals. They privately are for it, probably,
They're for corporate income tax. How about moderates?
No, most of the moderates wouldn't go that far. Most of the people that call themselves moderates.
But he goes so far to say that if you had to have a tax increase, they'd favor corporate income tax?
Most of them wouldn't. No. That's too much of a symbol involving corporate hostility. I mean, when you get down to the issues, I mean, it doesn't really matter whether you say somebody's moderate or not. Okay, test them on a corporate income tax. You know, they're for it, they're against it, or they have no position. If they have no position, they're probably a moderate.
We now have a definition. We have a definition. You're neutral on the corporate income tax makes you moderate.
Nah, you know we're being whimsical. Why not be whimsical?
That's the best definition we've got so far.
Yeah, we're serious. We're not whimsical.
Okay, I'm moderate.
No, we're not putting you on. It says you come
I'm
down
putting you on.
About the liberals and the conservatives in Texas.
And then they're moderate.
I've been hearing about for 20 years.
Okay, well, now you take John Hill. He's probably going to say he's a moderate. And the reason he wants to say he's a moderate is he's afraid the conservatives will detect in him a liberal. And he's afraid the liberals will detect in him a conservative. So he says, I'm a moderate. And actually, he's a compound. He's got some liberal points and some conservative points.
You know, just your terms are in the opposite.
The terms are ridiculous. Liberal generally. Nah, they're shorthand. I mean,
Benson a moderate?
In my opinion, Benson is a conservative who is sounding moderate on the national context. He's carefully taken a position so hedged and so ideologically compound that he can call himself a moderate. But actually, what he's done is he's voted very conservative on some things, rather liberal on others. You know, he's a compound. Moderate is just it's like a watercolor or it's like pastel that you try to smear colors with. People take positions on issues, and probably the main reason we use labels is because people don't pay any attention to issues. Most people do not pay attention to issues, including most political scientists, including most writers of books, including most journalists.
So we're just about up to the subject of Benson. Anyway, let's let the tape run out, and we can flip it.
Okay, let's have another beer. I told that guy who's a member of the caucus that made me a delegate, I'd see him at 6:30. Is that all right? I feel I owe him a report on what happened in Kansas City. Can I have another beer, gentlemen? DeVries is a coffee freak. How about you?
Yes. Do you want more?
I probably better shift to coffee.
Coffee? Two coffees and a shrimp?
Yeah, right. I'm the drunk in the crowd.
No, you catch up. I had a head start.
Are we eating oysters after this?
You going to the oyster bar?
Is that good?
Yeah, it is.
Is it fresh?
You've got me there. I've never eaten oysters there.
Okay.